Accession number 27249, Mr. Tom Tate, Reel 8. Now, we were talking about this long march you went on from Lagerfeld. Now, which way were you going?
We were going southeast. Southeast.
And do you know the route, any village, any place you passed through, or you know, were you not really aware of where?
No, we weren't really aware of where we went, but I did keep a record of where I went, so I have got a record, you see. But I do remember one place we passed through was Augsburg, A-U-G-S-Burg, because I remember Augsburg was a daylight raid on a ball bearings works in about 1943 by the RAF, but I didn't see any sign of any damage when we went through. But that was years later. But other than that, oh, we went through one big town on the Rhine, one big town on the Rhine, which I have a note of, should have had the...
Don't worry.
...diary with me, on the Rhine, and... on the Danube. Yes, on the Danube, going southeast, Danube. And... otherwise, we didn't live under cover at all anywhere, except we were lucky enough now and again to spend the night in a barn. And that went on from the 2nd of April to the 27th of April.
Now, were you getting any food during this march?
Very little food, because the Germans were unable to pick up, they were to pick up food on the way. There were no facilities other than picking up food from the various villages that we passed through, and the villages could not supply food. So sometimes we didn't seem to get anything at all, and the fellows had to use their initiative. We'd get potatoes, we'd exchange potatoes for our possessions. I have cigarette lighter or something we'd give, and people would give us a sack of potatoes, they would give us apples. Yes, I must say the civilians were very good indeed. And then we would dig on our patch when we pulled up for the night, we would spread out, and any dandelions within that patch, we'd dig them up and we boiled them. And we regard that as good nourishment. And what was left of the Red Cross parcels, and there wasn't much of that left, was helpful, but there wasn't much of that left. So we survived in that way.
What was the weather like?
Well, like in this country, it could have been, it was very cold, we had frost, we had rain, and then we had some nice warm days. We seemed to quickly get used to it. We were given one blanket between two men when we started out. I don't remember what happened to my blanket, but we were given one blanket, and we seemed to quickly settle down to get used to those conditions, believe it or not. I only had my battle dress. I didn't have any waterproofs.
I presume you were in a better physical state than most of the men on the march, who'd been prisoner for longer.
I hadn't been prisoner very long, that's exactly right, yes.
So, what happened next then?
Well, on the 25th, we arrived at a village called Ettringen.
Called what?
Ettringen. E-T-T-R-I-N-G-E-N. Ettringen. And believe it or not, as the German authorities had said at the beginning of the march, we're taking you to Switzerland. And in the distance, about 40 kilometres distant, we saw the Swiss Alps. Now, that's the 25th. Now, one of the English officers, Ricks his name is, became quite famous because Ricks had the nerve to make himself known to the Lord Mayor and persuaded him that it would be better for him to surrender and hang out white flags on the 27th, the morning of the 27th, because the Americans were coming in. What did you ask me?
Well, I was just asking what happened next. I mean, so what this officer persuaded the mayor to
surrender and have white flags hanging up there. And then Ricks came to see me and a fellow officer who I had befriended and said, tomorrow morning, that will be on the 27th, I want you to go up this high street to the other side of the village, the other end of the village, and a welcome party for the American tanks which will be coming in. And so we set out to do that, and halfway there we were stopped by an SS officer who was driving a jeep, and he was standing there in his jack boots and his skull and crossbones on his helmet, and he asked what we were doing. And believe it or not, I thought this was where we were going to be killed, simply because I was on my right. I had a German officer who was carrying a white flag, believe it or not, an army officer carrying a white flag. God, I thought, he'll shoot him, and then he'll shoot us when he hears we're RAF prisoners or something. But fortunately, they spoke, and he went off. And believe it or not, he parked his jeep in a farm building, and he blew it up. However, we couldn't get to the other end of the village, because no sooner were we almost there, and a tremendous amount of gunfire broke out, the Americans were already coming in, and we hadn't done our little bit of duty, unfortunately. What happened was that the Americans were coming in, and they saw this German tank, which had surrendered to Ricks. But the Americans didn't realise that, and they opened fire as soon as they saw the tank, and all the crew were killed and the rest of it. However, we went back to our billet, which was in this farm building, and then we spent the rest of the day and following days disarming the German forces. It was the most comical farce. That one day we were prisoners of war, and the next day the Germans were prisoners of war, and we were disarming them. Farce. Amusing. And then we were there for about 10 days waiting for to be airlifted home. And when the airlift people came, it was about, it seemed like hundreds of aircraft, Dakotas, that's right, the Dakotas, doing a circus around the airfield, landing one at a time, all landing more or less the same, following each other, and they took us to Reims, where at Reims airfield we saw all the Lancasters lining the runways. A most emotional moment with Lancasters and the crew standing outside, those young fellows standing outside those aircraft. And believe it or not, the first crew I saw, it was one crew that I had been their staff instructor. So what a wonderful greeting. You know, life's full of these contrasts, absolute hell and absolute joy.
What happened? You flew to Reims and then back to Britain.
Yes, brought back to this country. Yes,
and that'd be in May.
That's right. Yes.
Now, what happened when you got back? I mean, you were still in the RAF, of course.
When I got back, yes, you know, debriefed, and I told them about Hockenfeld, debriefed, and then you're re-kitted if you need re-kitting. Yes, I needed some boots and shoes. I'd lost those. Then you're sent on leave. You're sent on leave for about a month, I should think, a long leave. But when I'd been on leave about a week, Matthew's father, he'd found my address and he called on me. And he said his son hadn't come home. And four other crew had not come home. And I could only say to him, well, Well, I can only say what I've told you. Well, I've told no. I can only say that I escaped, and I don't know what happened to anyone. I was told that they had not been hurt, or they were safe, except for one who had been injured. That's exactly what, that's all I know at the time. And he went off. And within a month, the Air Ministry telephoned me to say, the other men, the five men, have not come home, and you must be prepared to travel out to this village, find where this village is. I wasn't even quite sure what the name of it, but I knew it was near Pforzheim. Find this village, you go with an army officer who will investigate this. So off we set, we went to this village. I was now in a jeep, I wasn't walking at all. And we went down the village high street, turned right along to the church, went into the churchyard, and there were these five graves. He then proceeded to talk to people in the village, getting names, witnesses, all that sort of thing. And then I came home, and for the next 12 months I was involved with the Judge Advocate General's office in London, giving evidence, swearing affidavits, all that sort of thing. And within a year, the following July, I attended the war crimes trial in Essen with Bradley.
So that'd be in 1946.
That's right.
About were you on any other duties, or was this your main thing?
When you say, was I? Yeah, no, I was on other duties, inasmuch as they wanted to demobilise me right at the beginning, and I wouldn't have that. I said, I've always wanted one of those jobs in Whitehall. A penguin in Whitehall. I always wanted to be a penguin in Whitehall. So they said, what can you do? I said, well, I've passed the Chartered Institute Secretaries, accountancy and all those subjects for the intermediate. Oh, so you're an accountant? Well, I said yes. And so, all right, they gave me a job in Air Ministry Unit in Hallam Street behind the BBC. It's next to Harley Street. It was the wartime doctor's headquarters. And I did the accounts for special sort of officers there, especially those on who were spies, not spies, agents in France, and all that sort of thing.
And you did that 1945 to 1946?
I did that for nearly for a year, till some smart ass said to me one day, oh, your number's up, you should have been out a long time ago.
Now, what about, tell me about the war crimes trial. That was in Essen. When was that? Tell us about that.
Well, that's in about July 1946. And Bradley and I went to Essen. And the trouble with those crimes, the trouble with the trial was that we didn't take part in it, except we were called into court 4 days after we arrived, and on the fifth day we were told by the prosecuting officer, after having been interviewed by the prosecution, the defence, if any witnesses made any comments, I don't know about that, but I was asked to identify, if I could identify any of those 22 people in the dock, etc. And on the fifth day...
Could you?
Yes. Yes, I did recognise one, yes. And he was the bloke that hit me. So anyway, I saw close enough. And afterwards he admitted that he was there. Denied it at the time, but afterwards he admitted... Anyway, on the fifth day we were told by the prosecuting officer, you can go home. This trial will go on for weeks yet. You can go home. And so I came home not having heard the evidence. But although I realised that it had all been planned, it had been planned for the Kreisleiter to take revenge for the bombing of Pforzheim. And that was the whole purpose of the thing.
Now, so, and they were found guilty, these men?
Three were hung, I've got all this correspondence outside, actually. But never mind, you don't problem. Three were hung. Nine had about 15-year sentences. And there were several 5-year sentences. But the youths, they seemed to get 2 years. They were taking part. And they had admitted, using the pistols, they'd been briefed and told to do that. They got 2 years. About three or four of those.
You obviously thought that wasn't sufficient.
Well, no. I took the view that they had done as they were ordered. They had been taken out and told to practice firing these pistols, and then they were ordered to take part in this demonstration, to be dressed as civilians so that they would appear to be refugees from the bombing, and they were to be armed with pistols.
You see what I mean? Does that mean they should have got more or less? If they were under orders, does that mean you thought they shouldn't have got as much, or do you?
When they're under orders, they couldn't ignore the Nazi orders, because you'd be officers complained about the treatment of you.
So you felt generally
they were told they would be cashiered.
So the sentences that some of them were hung, some of them long prison sentences. Some you thought that was that appropriate overall.
Well, I suppose it was, really, bearing in mind that men were murdered.
Now, did this leave you with a lasting opinion of the Germans at the time? I mean, how did you feel about the incident generally?
Well, I felt that they had little choice, really, because I feel sure those things probably happened in this country when Liverpool were bombed, for instance. Housewives came rushing out with their saucepans to batter any German pilot, only Luftwaffe pilot to death, in a way. Those things must have happened in this country. They happen in any country when the civilians take revenge. But the worst thing about this was it was planned.
But you, like in this article, it says that you vowed never to go back to Germany. I mean, that doesn't quite sit with what
you just said. I haven't arrived home yet.
Right.
But because of my experience of how they went about it, the Kreisleiter ringing up his pals, SS, the SA, and the Nazi Hitler Youth to execute the airmen as spies in the cellar of the school, as was planned, I thought that was quite dreadful. And so I said to my wife, I'll never go to Germany again in my life.
Now, we'll come back to that, because that obviously runs on. What about the next thing that happens? Which your demobilisation would be the next thing. You've been an accountant until 1940.
Right.
When were you demobilised?
Well, that would be spring of 1946, wouldn't it be?
1946.
Well, you got my logbook, doesn't it say there?
Well, the logbook won't say it, will it? I mean, that finishes in 1944.
Did it? Oh, what a pity.
Now, we've sorted out the demob thing, and it was basically that you were demob just before the trial, which was in spring of 1946.
In about May, yes.
Now, so you were demobilised then?
Yes.
Now, could you just briefly tell us, you went back to your old job, which was...
Anglo-American Corporation, yes.
And this was a sort of general secretarial and work as a company registrar.
That's right, yes.
A variety of duties.
Yeah,
and that was to be your working career?
That was my career, yes. And I finished up with the assistant registrar there.
They treated you well during the war, hadn't they?
Yes, I was on half pay all those years.
So, while you were away at the war. Now, what we really want to concentrate is this business of reconciliation, because, and although this has been described, and they can listen to this in a thing called the Rocking Rocking Horse of Hoke, or yeah, called Hoke,
called
a BBC
called Hope, yes.
program, which we have in the archive.
Yes.
You want to make some points about how you feel about what happened to you in this process of reconciliation.
Well, how it came about.
Yeah, how it came about and how it affected you.
Well, the remarkable thing was that after I said to my wife, I'll never go to Germany again in my life, 50 years passed by. And then that's 50 years. That is 1995. Now, in 1991, my wife passed away. And strangely, in view of what happened next, I considered that Madam Fate had taken a hand. There was no reason why I shouldn't accept, why I should regard my threat never to go to. In 1994, sitting in my golf club, having a drink with my pal, I heard a man say, I went on a holiday down the Rhine this year. It was absolutely marvellous. So I said to Bill Bradford, my pal, I wouldn't mind going on those holidays down the Rhine. This was all pie in the sky because it was something to say. It sounded exciting. And he said, Saga do that tour. Why don't you give him the ring? I know, I'm a member, I will give him the ring. And so I received details of the Saga holidays, Rhine holidays for next year. Within a day or two, I received the Saga magazine. And although I didn't open it until November, when I was going to throw it away, but something made me open it. I said to myself, look, they took the trouble to send it to you, at least take an interest. So I opened it up, and damn it, in the middle page, a double page, the village that asks forgiveness. And it was a story of my crew in Fort Sine being murdered and all the rest of it, the whole story. And it was that John Wynne, he had also been traced. We, none of us had been traced, but John Wynne had been traced in 1994, 1995, and he had presented a rocking horse to the kindergarten in as a symbol of reconciliation. So I hadn't spoken to John Wynne since 1945, when I came back to this country. And so I got onto the editor, he put me onto John Wynne. John Wynne rang me and said, you will have to go to Germany. The people have prayed to meet a survivor. They wish to reveal their sorrow, their shame. You'll have to go. And that's how I went back to Germany, and I was greeted like a little hero.
How did you feel before you went back?
In trepidation, I felt very worried, because I thought it's an opportunity for someone to finish what they started. And I didn't actually go for the date of the commemoration. I went a week afterwards. But I was welcomed with open arms. How can you have enemy feelings towards people who come to you and open their arms and hug you like that? And that's what everyone in the village did. Marvellous. Fantastic.
And you met Wynne again as well, did you?
Well, I went to see Wynne in Wales. Yes, I stayed with them a couple of weeks. I also went to Wales to meet the children that come over from Fort Sine, because they have these reciprocal holidays for kids. Landbetter kids go to 1 year to Germany. The Germans come to Landbetter the following week. It's all part of reconciliation.
And there's also a German lad's grave. Can you tell that story? Because that's
That was very sad. When I went up to on the Sunday, Gotthilf took me up to the cemetery, and whereas he wanted to go and visit a grave, he said, "You go and stand at the your people, and have a look at it."
That's a plaque erected to the memory of
on the church wall in memory of the five people. And I was standing there, and a young woman who had been attending a grave not far away, she walked down to me and she said, I'm not sure if she said in German or English, but she said to me, are you English or something like that? And I said, yes. And then she said something, and I said, oh, my brother. She said, my brother, 1945, Pforzheim, 1945. And I said, my comrades. And then she realised who I was, and suddenly she broke down, and I was most emotionally upset, and I took her and I held her, and we supported each other for quite a long while. So we made very emotional contact, and we have become, she's pleased to be a friend of the reconciliation group now through that.
And this reconciliation process is obviously very important to you. I mean, do you want to say anything about reconciliation generally with Germany, or the Germans?
Well, I despair at the behaviour of human beings, but I must only say of the reconciliation of people in Huckenfeld and some people in Pforzheim. Pforzheim's so big that reconciliation hasn't got to their hearts yet, but Huckenfeld is troubled by the dreadful things that were done in their village in the war. That's why no one ever spoke of what went on. And now they're happy. It's all been revealed. All been revealed. That's why it was important for me to go there, so they could declare their shame, get rid of their shame, to be
purged.
They wish to pay a penitent. They wish to be penitent about it. Yes, that's right.
Thank you very much.